More information and tickets available at universe.com and kpfk.org.
You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and live around the world at kpfk.org.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. We live in a global world. We are all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities, are responding. We also discuss the relationship between art and politics. Now to news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. Bosnian Serb General Ratko Mladic, who led the siege of Sarajevo in the 1990s and carried out the worst massacre in Europe since World War II, has died while serving a life sentence on war crimes charges. The Serbian state RTS television and the official Bosnian Serb television reported the news. He was 84. The reports said that Mladic died in a UN prison hospital in The Hague, Netherlands. Mladic's family confirmed the reports. The United Nations Tribunal for War Crimes committed during the Yugoslavia wars in the 1990s sentenced Mladic to life in prison in 2017 in what was considered a key step toward bringing justice to the victims. He'd been in custody since 2011 after many years on the run. Meta faces major changes to its Instagram and Facebook platforms, as well as a $17 billion fine after reaching a settlement agreement with dozens of states in a federal trial over its social media service and how it affects children. The social media giant reached the deal with California and several other states Wednesday at a federal court in Oakland. More from Ira Spitzer.
Meta has admitted no wrongdoing, but this is the first time that the company will have to submit to mandated fundamental changes to their platform. When you look at what they've agreed to here with the two-hour limit for teenagers, as well as the changes to aspects of the like notification and certain filters and things of that nature, this really is a victory for those U.S. states who had been seeking many of those changes.
That's Ira Spitzer. Nepalese and Chinese authorities say the official death toll in the massive floods that hit the country this week has risen to at least 353. Hundreds more people are listed as missing. More from Neha Punya in New Delhi.
At least 400 people still unaccounted for in Nepal, many of them foreign nationals, including 100 Indian tourists across the border in Tibet, which is controlled by China. Chinese state media are saying that more than 500 people are unaccounted for. We have seen the sort of devastation this disaster has left behind, large swaths of land completely covered by mud.
That's Neha Punya. The number of people filing for U.S. unemployment benefits fell last week, remaining at historic lows, as layoffs are rare and most Americans enjoy a measure of job security. The Labor Department reported today that jobless claims slipped to 203,000 last week from a revised 207,000 the week before. The four-week average of claims, which smooths out week-to-week ups and downs, ticked up slightly to 205,500. Claims for jobless benefits are a proxy for layoffs, and economists watch them because they can provide early clues of where the job market is headed. For the past year, claims have mostly been at a historically low range of around 200 to 230,000 a week. An Immigration and Customs Enforcement officer charged with shooting a man and lying about it during the immigration crackdown in Minneapolis has been released from a Texas jail after a judge refused to order his return to Minnesota. Christian Castro was released today from a detention center in Brownsville on the border with Mexico. Castro was charged in Minnesota with assault and falsely reporting a crime in the January shooting of Julio Cesar Sosa Celis. Under Texas law, Castro had to be released from jail today. Minnesota officials believe Castro could flee to Mexico. Russia has launched a major attack on Ukraine that targeted 9 cities with missiles and drones. The assault began last night and continued into today. The strike hit areas such as the capital Kyiv and caused civilian casualties. Ukrainian officials say that Russia builds up missile stocks to exhaust air defenses. Ukraine has targeted Russian sites, including online retailers, in response. Those are the Pacifica headlines. I'm Max Pringle.
Those were the news headlines from Pacifica Radio.
Blaze the fire.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy. Today on Sojourner Truth, we commemorate Black August by sharing a powerful Black August panel hosted by the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, also known as BAJI, followed by the incomparable Esther Arma and Don Brown, talking about saying goodbye to the emotional mammy and an important forum coming up next week. All this and more on Sojourner Truth. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy. We continue our commemoration of Black August with a powerful panel describing conditions in immigration detention that have led to the deaths of over 50 people since the Trump administration assumed power. This panel features Manuela, a Black woman from Cameroon who has been detained in Adelanto detention prison during this year. And she shares a harrowing account of her experience with ICE and with ICE detention. The panel also includes Mildred Taylor, wife of Rodney Taylor, a disabled Black man from Liberia who was detained at Stewart Detention Prison in Georgia for 15 months, as well as Shirley Leslie, National Development Director and support and volunteer with Critical Resistance. When we think about the 50 people or more that have died behind the walls in ICE detention, and we think of so many more who are suffering and have suffered from medical abuse and medical neglect, we wanted as BAJI to make sure to lift up that aspect of what's happening, because it is such a through line when we're talking about immigration prison or whether we're talking about criminal punishment system prison. And I'm so thrilled to begin this conversation with our sister, our comrade, the co-founder and main principal of the Free Rodney Taylor Committee, a civic and engagement associate in Georgia with BAJI, Mildred. How are you, Mildred? So glad to have you here, Mildred Deans Taylor.
I am well. I am grateful to be on this panel with you. Thank you. Thank you.
So let's first talk about the fact that he's out now. Thank God. Inshallah. Amen. And Ashe. But how long was Rodney detained in detention?
Rodney was detained for 471 days. That's 15 months, just about 15 months in detention. Rodney was detained here in Georgia, in Lumpkin, Georgia, a very rural town in Stewart County, in Stewart Detention Center.
And Rodney, you know, we wanted to lift up his story because it's not often talked about what happens with people who have disabilities or accessibility needs in immigration detention. And so without going, I'm not trying to get his whole medical chart, but at least the basics of the disability, the accessibility needs that he has, so that we can better understand when we talk about what happened to Rodney and how it's so symbolic or so clear about what happens to other people.
Yeah, thank you for that. Rodney was born with several disabilities. He was born with a missing left foot, and he was born with a missing tibia on his right leg. Rodney became a double amputee by the time he was 10 years old. He arrived here from Liberia at the age of two. Rodney also had missing fingers in his right hand. So he has a full thumb and a partial pinky. When Rodney was detained, being a disabled man, Rodney faced several different things. One, he's Black. Two, he's disabled. Blacks often get the worst treatment in detainment. They're usually the ones that get deported first. They're usually the ones that get very minimal medical support. And Rodney faced that immediately. Rodney prosthetics requires electrical charging. Rodney cannot walk without the prosthetics being charged. For several days, he couldn't walk. He was not provided a shower stool. When Rodney had to remove the prosthetics because they cannot get wet, he was not afforded a shower stool to take a shower. Rodney cannot walk long distances as a result of the prosthetics. Oftentimes, they did not provide him access to meals. So he went many days and weeks without food. Then when they did give him a wheelchair, they know he can't use his hands because he's missing fingers. He was at the mercy of other detainees to wheel him around. Rodney faced medical neglect. And oftentimes we thought he was going to die in detention because we saw all the stories of other detainees getting killed, murdered because of medical neglect. And that was a fear that we had for Rodney.
And I want to, you know, help people to have a sense of some of the ways in which those accessibility needs that you're describing were not met. So, for example, when you talk about Rodney not being able to have meals, talk about like what was needed for him to get to food. And I really want you to talk about that conversation where they dared to raise up Uber Eats.
Oh, yeah. When Rodney entered detention, he had a set of prosthetics waiting for him. The ones he was wearing was a loaner. They were too small, which means it's like wearing shoes that's two sizes too small. And it like that chafing, rubbing of the skin, of the inside of the soles. That's what Rodney feels whenever he takes a step in the prosthetic. So it was excruciating. It felt like needle-like pins in his skin every time he took a step. So it was hard to walk. The cafeteria to his cell was the length of a football field each way. So you got breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So six times a day, he's required to walk this length, and it caused bruising and chafing. Rodney told the guards, he told the people, hey, I can't walk. Can you guys send someone, accommodate me, basically accommodate my disability by sending someone to grab my meals? Well, the warden got upset. He said, well, we can't accommodate you. If we do that for you, we got to do that for everybody. This is not Uber Eats. So for a month and a half, Rodney went without food, without being able to go to the cafeteria to get food. He was at the liberty again of another detainee. Then when he came to the shower stools, let's go back to the cafeteria. The cafeteria doesn't have accessible tables for people with wheelchairs. So even when he was provided a wheelchair, he couldn't sit at a regular table. So he would sit with the tray on his lap, off to the side. He couldn't sit on the tables that was provided. The shower stools, he was provided a shower stool at one point, and then they removed it out of a retaliation. Every time I spoke to a reporter, every time I spoke to the news about Rodney's situation, they would the warden in the detention center and ICE would retaliate against Rodney and take things away from him, like meals, shower stools, access to medical he went a long time without being able to take a shower. As a matter of fact, when Rodney was released is when he actually took a real good shower. He didn't have access to a shower stool from January of 2026 up until May 1st after he was released is when he was able to finally take a shower, because during that length, he didn't have access to a shower stool. So he would take, I would call monkey baths for safety reasons.
No, thank you for that. I think that's important for people to understand, you know, to hear these things, right? Because it's like, if I don't have my prosthetics and the situation that I'm in, then I've got to get on that nasty floor. You expect me to crawl on that floor. I don't have a stool, so I guess I'm supposed to hop and turn water on and hop and turn water off under those conditions. And they knew what those conditions were, and right. They did not care. I'm going to come back to you as we proceed, and thank you so, so very much. I want us to hear from someone who actually also has been in detention, detained in Adelanto here in California. Rodney Taylor was detained in Stewart Detention Center, or there was detention, they call it center, we call it prison. And we're going to hear from someone who was detained in Adelanto now. After that, on the other side of that, want to speak with you, Shirley Leslie, about how this connects with what happens in criminal punishment prison. And then, of course, we'll continue the conversation. Let us please play that audio again from Manuela.
Hi, my name is Manuela. I'm a Cameroonian national and a Californian for almost 2 decades. I was kidnapped and trafficked by ICE agent at the beginning of the year. Thank you for the opportunity to make a public record of the year my experience and continue to experience. Often, the voice of Black immigrants are erased in this discussion, and I am here to share not just my experience, but to shed light on the stories of the Haitian, Ghanaian, Jamaican, Congolese, and other Black immigrant women in detention at Adelanto and other detention centers. My experience in ICE custody was violent and degrading, and has caused me significant emotional distress. During a routine ICE check-in in April this year, I was detained and possibly transported to Adelanto ICE Processing Center without explanation. Despite ICE assuring me that I could contact my family, ICE denied me the opportunity to see, speak with, or say goodbye to my daughter on the day I was detained. I was restrained with tight chains around my wrist and ankle, causing pain and difficulty using the restroom and maintaining basic hygiene. I was in physical discomfort, emotional distress, and fear while in detention. I was treated disrespectfully over and over again. For instance, I was rushed and denied privacy while using the bathroom. During transfer from facility, they put us in a very cold freezer-like rooms. Before and during detention, officer and security staff frequently use abusive language, yelled and pressured people to sign documents, including voluntary departure forms. Agent intimidated and attempted to pressure me to sign false documents. Condition at Adelanto are deplorable. It was overcrowded and unsanitary. We clean our own bathroom and dining area with little to no disinfectant and without gloves. The air conditioning often did not work, and insects were common. I slept on the floor the first night I got there because I could not safely access my assigned top bunk and waited for 4 days for a lower bed. We were given spoiled or unsafe food, and when I refused meals, I was threatened with solitary confinement. The tap water there caused stomach pain. Showers and toilet were limited and had no access. We had no access to windows or an outside view. Medical neglect was rampant at Adelanto. I was witness with a young Black woman who had a seizure and not received immediate medical attention despite having visible injury on her body. When I fell in the shower, I was only given painkiller a few days later and was not offered any medical support, not an examination, nor an x-ray. I have since developed constant and excruciating back pain and shoulder pain. Although I have been released from Adelanto, I remain under surveillance where ICE monitor my movement and activities via an ankle GPS. monitor phone check-ins through the BI Smart Link app and in-person home visit described as intensive supervision. I am expected to be home from 6 a.m. until 5 p.m. for the home visit, yet they never show up the first time, and my movement is limited in case they do show up. This ongoing monitoring causes significant stress and emotional distress. My daughter has also noticed the impact of this restriction on my daily life. On one occasion, when I went to the federal building with my father, security personnel reacted strongly to my ankle monitor and made me lift my pant to show it, which was very embarrassing. With this syringe, ICE constrained my movement, limiting my ability to make a living and do other daily activities like groceries, shopping, going to church, or visiting family and friends. I cannot even go to the DMV because they took my driver license. So with my immigration status pending, my life remained in limbo. And at the hands of the federal government, my parents, who are both in their 70s with chronic illness, and my daughter have been distraught at my treatment. Thank you.
We want to thank Manuela for sharing that. Let's give it up for Manuela. It's very brave. It's not easy to tell your story, to talk about what's happened to you, especially in the context of that kind of effort purposefully to dehumanize you, purposefully to terrorize you, and speaks to some of what Mildred has spoken about in terms of use of medical abuse as a form of control, as a form of punishment, as a form of manipulation. And I know that Shirley Leslie can speak also to how that happens in prisons, because we want to make sure to connect what is going on in criminal punishment prison with what is going on in detention prison. And so pleased to have you here, National Development Director of Critical Resistance, who has made Critical Resistance also your political home. So it's not just your gig. Started there as a volunteer and then decided to jump in all the way. And so thank you so much, Shirley, for being here. If you could share, because everyone that is here with us may not know, talk a little bit about Critical Resistance and, you know, its connection even in terms of the work you do with Black August. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, of course. Hi, everyone. Good to be here. So grateful to be sharing the space. Critical Resistance, or CR, as you may hear me refer to it, is a national grassroots org that is working to build an international movement to end the prison industrial complex by challenging the belief that caging and controlling people makes us safe. And the prison industrial complex, or PIC, is a term that we use to describe the overlapping interests of government and industry that use surveillance, policing, imprisonment as solutions to economic, social, and political problems. So we have lots of campaigns and projects that we've historically been involved in to shut down jails, prisons, to resist the harms of policing, to build up community tools and skills to respond to emergency and harm, and lots of other things historically. And as of right now, we have 5 chapters: Oakland and Los Angeles, California, Portland, Oregon, New York City, and a regional chapter in Central Appalachia. They're all taking on different types of campaigns and community work, from shutting down California prisons to making it so that across the state of New York, state jails and prisons can't collaborate with ICE and immigrant detention facilities, agencies, doing a lot of anti-policing work in Portland and really trying to seed and deepen abolitionist organizing and sentiment within the Central Appalachian region. And of course, just creating a lot of different concrete organizing tools, including our abolitionist newspaper that we work on both inside and outside of prison walls. And we distribute to over 5,000 imprisoned subscribers for absolutely free. So that's a little bit of what we've historically done and what we're currently doing. And yeah, can definitely speak to its connection to Black August. That seems like I can do the deep dive here.
All right. Thank you so much for that. And really, yes, the work of Critical Resistance has been critical in the work that has happened. I mean, it's not definitely true to this, not new to this in terms of the time that Critical Resistance has put in and the length of time and the effort that Critical Resistance has put in towards prison abolition. When I'm sure that when you were listening to Mildred talk about what happens with respect to medical abuse in detention, what happens in terms of even the conditions of the immigration prisons, and then you hear Manuela also talking about that and the use of, you know, the way that people are under the control, the use of control to punish, and even to the degree of using people's disabilities, people's medical needs as a way of control and punishment. And, you know, I think about what happened to the sisters, the Cameroonian sisters in Huta, who complained, this was back in 2020, and how they were treated. They went on strike talking about medical abuse and how they were attacked. I think about those sisters and others at Stewart Detention Prison, who literally were partially, in some cases, fully attacked in terms of their reproductive rights. And then some of them deported to try to get them out the way before anything could happen. And we know the same thing has happened to women in California prisons, for example. We know that the same thing happens in terms of this medical abuse in these prisons, and that this is an example of why it's abolish and not just make the prison nicer. Talk about that, please.
Yep. Thank you for sharing some of the examples that I'm going to get into. As prison industrial complex abolitionists, we understand that abuse and neglect are just part and parcel of the PIC. I'm sure we've all seen reports of the abysmal conditions of the food inside prisons, and y'all spoke to that even before now, as we're seeing reports emerge pointing to creatures in the food. CR has engaged in campaigns to close local dilapidated jails as well that were earthquake unsafe in San Francisco, within a state that is more prone to others for earthquakes. Prisons and nearby prison towns in California, and again, I'd hazard a guess in many places elsewhere, are subject to toxic land, air, and water conditions, all causing sickness. Prisons and cages of all types are places that disable people or worsen existing disabilities, which you, Nana, Mildred spoke to a little bit earlier, that we were hearing in the recording as well. And so regardless of the conditions of the buildings themselves, prisons and cages and the practicing of caging is just rife as major sites of sexual, physical, psychological harm too. So I did want to name that. And one of the examples that I think you were hinting at, Nana, is an example within California of a federal women's prison in Dublin, California, which was long a site of rampant sexual abuse by the guards. And as we were seeing more attention called to this abuse, the prison was closed, but mainly to avoid any reckoning. And a lot of the survivors of that abuse who were organizing among each other to take action were transferred elsewhere and away from each other just to make it that much harder to organize together. And of course, clear retaliation. And even after all that, ICE are looking to reopen that Dublin prison as an immigrant detention center. So one, highly encourage y'all to check out the work of longtime CR comrades, California Coalition for Women Prisoners, who are heavily holding down that solidarity work with the survivors of abuse in Dublin, and the ICE Out of Dublin Coalition working to ensure that that prison isn't reopened. And maybe just one other example that I want to show in relation to the ways that exactly what you were saying, Nana, punishment, isolation, abuse, neglect are all wielded as weapons is one. I'd like to name the use of solitary confinement, a torturous method if there ever was one. Years ago, CR responded to calls from folks inside California prisons that were being held in indefinite solitary confinement. And we joined the leadership of a coalition supporting both 2011 and 2013 prisoner-led hunger strikes in California. And all of those protracted efforts led to a massive reduction of the use of indefinite solitary confinement within California and gained international recognition of solitary confinement as torture. So I just wanted to name some of those things. And through this particular undertaking across prison walls, prisoner-led efforts made the use of something like solitary confinement controversial. So these historical and, of course, really unfortunately current and recent examples and the stories that y'all have been sharing and that we heard across the recording, we're seeing the PIC working to shape shift and expand. And through all those things, we see again that abuse and neglect are just an inherent part of the prison industrial complex, which is why we work so tirelessly to dismantle it, change common sense around it, and build what we need for our communities to be actually healthy.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. And that was Mildred Taylor, Manuela, and Shirley Leslie, connecting the dots between criminal punishment prison, immigration detention prison, and the legacy of Black August resistance. More Sojourner Truth, saying goodbye to the emotional mammy after this short break.
90.7 KPFK, Los Angeles.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. Might you be an emotional mammy? Might I be? My next guests are going to break down what it means to be an emotional mammy, the impacts of the harm, and an upcoming opportunity in Los Angeles to let that energy go and get back on your journey of becoming. Esther Arma is a self-described global Black chick, founder of the Arma Institute of Emotional Justice, writer and director of the short film, Goodbye to the Emotional Mammy. She is also a speaker at the upcoming Black Women Nonprofit Leaders Forum, where her film will be screened, followed by a workshop with the women gathered. Esther is also an author, playwright, and creator of the framework Emotional Justice and the 10-year global initiative Moving Masculinity. Don L. Brown is executive director at Empower Her Institute and the visionary behind the upcoming Black Women's Nonprofit Leaders Forum in September 3rd, whose theme is rooted in purpose and called to rise. Empower Her Institute is designed to empower girls and young women in marginalized communities by giving them the skills necessary through education, training, and mentorship to become confident, collected, clear-eyed, and career-ready.
Greetings, Esther and Dawn. So pleased to be joined by two sisters that are getting it done. Thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting us. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to join you, Nana. Pleasure to be with you, Dawn.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
So I want to start first, you know, you call anything a mammy, it's provocative. Emotional mammy definitely is provocative. And I think that role that Black women can often play is not talked about enough. You know, as I was looking through some of this, I was like, ooh, Nana, are you an emotional mammy in this movement space? Talk about that. I want to first just talk, Esther, about where this work comes from, because it's such an important work and everyone is not doing it and you do it so brilliantly. And then let's talk about the emotional mammy piece itself.
Black women need emotional justice. We need to reckon with, name, and navigate this legacy of untreated trauma that shapes how we see ourselves and each other based on the systems of harm, the legacies of enslavement, colonialism, and apartheid that shape us. The term emotional mammy comes out of the emotional justice framework. It is a framework that I built that said very simply, we have treated healing like a side chick. Dip in, dip out. Give it a little bit of attention, but healing is never wifey. Healing is never the main squeeze, and healing is not the main stage. But the reality is, in this time where our labor, physical, sexual, and in this case, emotional, has built and shaped worlds, but is tearing ours down, there has to be a reckoning and an internal revolution. So what emotional justice is about saying is that we need framework, we need language, we need an approach, we need a model, and we need resources. So what I did was to build them. I self-identify as a global Black chick because the emotional justice framework is shaped by the years that I lived in New York, so navigating being Black in America, the years I spent as a Black Briton, born and raised in London, and now being here in Accra. And so if we just go right to the definition, we know the term mammy comes out of the legacy of enslavement, traditionally very a visual reality, usually a large, dark-skinned woman who took care of white families. It was very much the physical labor, looking after them, cooking, cleaning, taking care of the family, but not just taking care of the family, that it was a joy for her to do that, that there was nothing else in her life than the joy of taking care of this family. There was the expectation and the demand that she take care of the family. Nobody ever asked her about her family and what does it mean or what is she leaving behind. It was all about centering the physical well-being of the white family. The emotional mammy is a Black woman, any hue, any shape, any size, that is expected to center, cater, and prioritize the feelings of white people, centrally white men, but white people, and all men, no matter the toll, the cost, and the consequence to her, her health, her well-being, and her future. And the reality is, as Black women, we have been nurtured to be emotional mammies and to treat that as some kind of badge of honoring. What we are, our power, our significance, our contributions is measured by one, how much we endure and how much we give. When we don't do either of those, we are judged, we are shamed, and we are silenced. And never just by the wider society, but that happens within our own community, by Black men, and among and between each other, because part of what white supremacy has taught all of us is that your central function and role is a service that never includes you as a Black woman. And as long as the service doesn't include you, you have value. The moment it does, all kinds of questions and alarm bells and shaming occurs. Now, in this climate where literally Black women are being treated as if they are warfare, their being, their very being, their desire to build, to breathe, to be, to shape a future for themselves and their families and their people is being treated as if it is an imminent threat to all that is white, supremacist, and delusional. The result of that is what I call an emotional paralysis. So in other words, you are navigating having everything thrown at you on a daily basis. This is being broken down. This is being torn down. This person is hanging from a tree. It's called a suicide. This person just disappeared. This person had this happen. This person had this person. And then all the global stuff is happening at the same time. And within all of that chaos, Black women are still expected to cater to and center the emotional needs of everybody else except for them. Goodbye to the emotional, mammy is an invitation, a resource, and a call to action. You don't do side chick in the story of your own reality. That cannot be your work, your world, or your future. But it's two things. It's one is asking yourself, have I ever been, or when have I been an emotional mammy in my life, in my job, to my family, to my organization? What has that looked like? What would it take for me to stop doing that? Not just what would it take, what might it cost? And am I willing to make the change? And to do so without shame, judgment, interrogation, or castigation. But it's what we call in emotional justice an intimate revolution, an internal reckoning. But we've got to have it. We've got to do it. So I'm very excited that the film "Goodbye to the Emotional Mammy," the 25-minute short film, will actually be being screened at the Black Women Nonprofit Leaders Forum in LA on September the 3rd, led by our visionary sister Dornell Brown, who is right here with us. It's such a critical moment for us to convene and gather. That's what we're doing.
Absolutely. And when you were talking, I'm glad, Esther, that you brought in also how we can be emotional mammies to our job, how we can be emotional mammies to our movement, right? Because some of us, like me, I would say, well, I'm an emotional mammy for no dude, but am I an emotional mammy for my, you know, work at Baji? Am I emotional mammy to this movement work? Yeah, that's when I start being a little softer, a little softer in my tone. And become a little more humble, because we know what is expected of us so often. And as you said, it's like if you're not giving everything and leaving it all on the floor and nothing for yourself, not even the bones, then folks look at you like you're not really leading and doing what you're supposed to do. I want to bring Dawn into this conversation. So thrilled that you're having this conference and that you are giving us the opportunity to show the film. And we'll talk about the conference in a moment, but want to talk about Empower Her Institute and about what you are doing right now with the Nonprofit Leaders Forum. But talk about the Institute first, just for those who may not know about it, and why the work that Esther is doing with respect to this healing on the emotion, in terms of our emotional healing, as well as this conversation about the emotional mammy, how does that connect with your work?
Yeah. So, you know, let me say that Empower Her Institute has been around for 23 years now. We work with girls between the ages of 11 through adulthood, and it's primarily Black and Brown girls here in LA County. Our ultimate goal is to break generational cycles of poverty. And we believe the best way to do so is through college and career readiness. But we take a whole child approach to how we support our girls. And the real vision is that in breaking generational cycles of poverty, and I say this as a woman who grew up in the projects in Washington, D.C., and had this amazing opportunity to go to an incredible high school of the arts and had a mother who worked three jobs to keep food on the table. And at that time, she made sure that there were these incredible women around me who supported me and was able to build a network for me. So working with Empower Her is important to me because I am getting to serve girls who come from communities like mine. 96% of our girls live at or below the poverty level, and I'm getting to serve girls who look like me. But what's more most important is that when I got into a place where I was able to go to NYU and then ultimately become a CEO, I didn't understand what it meant. Yes, I was able, I got out of the situation of poverty. I was able to make money, but I did. I had so much trauma and I had so much confusion around just funding money. And my trauma sort of led how I functioned in the world. And so in creating Empower Her, what we really do and me coming into the organization and leading it and redesigning it, we really want to look at breaking cycles of poverty from a perspective of trauma-informed services and how we support young people and girls now into addressing, into developing the skills to be fully healthy, functioning adult women in the world who are also leaders in the world. And so we look at that from five perspectives, from mental health and wellness. We look at that from financial literacy, because once they have the money, what do they do? How do they manage it? We look at it from trauma and support, immersive learning. So they're developing the skills now in order to be able to compete on a global scale. And we look at it and from a leadership perspective. And so that is who we are. That's what we do. Incredible programs and services. 100% of our middle schoolers matriculate into high school, and 100% of our high schoolers actually graduate and are accepted into college. And we serve over 1,000 girls a year, 900 of whom we see on a weekly basis. And so I won't go into the details of the of each of our programs, but listen, I've got 11-year-old scuba divers, certified scuba divers, who are, you know, in my who we are training and getting them the skills, who come in, can't swim, and then are leaving, diving 100 feet into the ocean and going to French Polynesia with us, right? So that is what we are, and that's what we do. In the midst of that, we had our girls go into college, and then they came back and was like, wait, you just left us. Like, we need help now. We need to figure this out now when we're now I'm in the world of employment. And what does that look like? And so we started a women's academy as a result of that, because we are a youth-led organization. We started a women's academy as a result of that in order to support adult women. And then I had to go back to my own thoughts and my own experiences before I came to Empower Her. And the fact that I was dealing with my own trauma from working in the nonprofit sector, being a Black woman in the nonprofit sector, we experienced misogyny in significantly high rates. And there are very little studies, but the studies that have come out show they all indicate how significant misogyny is within the Black, the nonprofit sector. And it is swept under the rug because you're in the help field. And so why in the world would you be experiencing any kind of ism, any kind of sexism, racism, you know, trauma, any kind of, why would you be feeling that? We're in the help field. So these are good white people. These are folks that, you know, we know that the majority of our funders, we know the majority of our board members for many Black-led nonprofits don't look like us. And so, but why would they ever? And so I had to really sit down with that and what I was experiencing. And I honestly thought it was something wrong with me. I thought it was something wrong with me when my board chair told me that the week that I took my weave out and I had my hair in an afro, that I looked too militant, and to change that back to how it looked before my meeting, the board meeting. I thought something was wrong with me, you know, when I was the COO and I had my white woman employee say, who is she to tell me what to do? And she was three levels below me, right? And went to the board and said that. And the board was like, Dawn, become more likable to her, right? Instead of having a conversation with her. So I was trying to bend and break into these boxes and literally praying to God that he broke me and bent me into these boxes. And it wasn't until I had a conversation with another friend of mine who was telling me about a friend of hers who was going through the same thing I was going through. My friend had no idea I was going through this. And She said, we've all been through it. And that's when I was like, oh my God, this is a real issue. This is not something wrong with me. And that's honestly how the forum was born. I said, I got to talk to other women and find out if this is going on. And so many Black women in the nonprofit sector was like, absolutely. This is what I'm experiencing. And I thought it was just me. And so I said, we got to create a space for us to come together and heal together. And that is where the forum was built. And, you know, when I hear Esther talk about the idea of being measured by how much we can endure, when we think about women in the help field, women who give of themselves each and every day, we are literally measured by how much we endure. You know, last week I worked until 4:30 in the morning, 3 days last week, and still had to get up at 7 a.m. And people were looking at me and saying, well, that's so great that you're so committed. Instead of, my God, girl, go sleep. Right. And so we talk about how we literally are breaking ourselves in the nonprofit sector, begging for money to support our communities. And it is exhausting and it beats us down. And so that's what this forum is about. And that's why we wanted to connect with Esther, because when we talk about emotional justice, I think often we forget the women who are looking beautiful out in the world and are changing the world and making big impact, but are literally sacrificing themselves in the process.
Right. And it's this thing of, you know, you cannot, we as Black women sometimes, we have PhDs in masking, but you cannot PhD your way out of untreated trauma.
Absolutely. And, you know, all of that resonates so much with me because people actually will congratulate you like, girl, go on. And you're like, girl, go on. I'm being driven into the ground. This is not working. Talk briefly, please, Esther, about the documentary share with us a little about how that came together and if when folks come to see it, what they should expect to see.
Goodbye to the Emotional Mammy is actually, it's a scripted narrative. It's a short film. It's a 30-minute short film. And the idea is very specific and simple. Black women are carrying this emotional weight. What does it look like to create the wellness that we need? And how do we connect to hold the hard conversations that we all know we may want and need to have, but we don't feel we have the entry points or the connectivity or even the permission to begin the conversation? So what Goodbye to the Emotional Mammy is, it's an invitation to enter into a different kind of conversation that says, Black women, this is not wellness in the form that the market has defined it. Because the market defines wellness in language that is about profit. This, for you, is about wellness in the face of warfare. And that's when wellness becomes a movement that is shaped by not just who you are, but who you've been. And the emotional inheritance you carry from the women who came before you and taught us that burnout is noble, honorable, and the price of demonstrating your commitment to liberation. And this has to be a generation that says, no, burnout is burnout and it will kill you. And you live in a world where society will step over your body to go do the next thing. And you may be mourned for a moment, but the movement of burnout will continue. So the only people that are ever going to be invested in stopping, transforming, and shaping a different future is us. Why? Because being an emotional mammy serves everybody except Black women. If you had somebody who centered your feelings in everything they did, you were the center of their world. What is the incentive for them to change it? It is Black women. The health studies that show that emotional suppression is literally creating an escalation in autoimmune diseases. Quite literally, there is a women's health crisis as a result of emotional suppression. Now, emotional suppression was a survival tool during enslavement, because you had to navigate the ongoing violence of white supremacy. It became learned internalized behavior as a survival skill to get through corporations and the world of nonprofits. Dawn's just told those two amazing stories. The idea that you're always being required to do what I call emotional shape-shifting. This emotion isn't safe coming out of your body. Shift it. Shift it into something more palatable, something more engageable, something more likable. There's no amount of change you will make that will satisfy society. So goodbye to the emotional mammy says goodbye, which means you've got to stop. Goodbye is not a moment. It's a movement that starts with making a connection, beginning a conversation, developing a set of tools, these tools that we call wellness in the face of warfare, that you can then go off and use in your leadership and in your organizations again and again and again. And part of that is what we call the becoming ceremony. So the becoming ceremony, which I'm going to introduce at the forum as a tool for us as Black women, is about creating space. Two Black women opposite each other. The becoming ceremony sent to 16-year-old girls, and then it's Black women of different generations having a conversation about emotional labor, honesty, transformation, and their personal histories. Because we know that our personal histories are shaped by politics, family, society, race, every ism that you can name. And so shaping a future means we center our wellness in ways that we haven't always done, but it is critical now in ways that we can't even imagine that it has ever been before.
Absolutely. Becoming. That is going to be fabulous. I really hope people will take advantage of that. Dawn, going to give you the last word so folks know where to go, what you're up to, what's happening, where's the forum? Please share that information. I know there are folks that really are going to want to go.
Absolutely. So the forum will take place on September 3rd, which is a Thursday. It starts at 9 a.m. and it runs until 5. We will be in Alhambra, California, which is right outside of Los Angeles, California, literally 5 minutes away. So we want people to come, go to our website, empowerher.org, which is empowerher.org, and you can get a ticket. And right now, if you use the code 75OFF, which is 75 off, you can get $75 off your ticket. If you are a woman who runs a nonprofit where your organization is less than $1 million and you financially cannot afford to purchase a ticket, then we will give you a scholarship so you can apply for a scholarship. We want any Black woman who wants to be a part to be a part of this.
Dawn Brown, Esther Arma, thank you so very much. Thank you for the work that you do all the time. And thank you for this moment that you've created, this moment that is part of a movement. We really appreciate you. Have a wonderful, wonderful rest of the day.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Nana. Lovely, lovely to be with you. Take care.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. And that was Esther Arma talking about her film, saying goodbye to the emotional mammy and to Dawn Brown, speaking on the upcoming Black Women's Nonprofit Leaders Forum. Sir Gary Scott. Of course, I'd like to thank you for joining us. Let's get together at the same time and place next week for Sojourner Truth Radio. Be well.
Support for KPFK comes in part from C-Sharp Entertainment, presenting El Dimeola live in concert, the Guitarchitect Tour, live at the Alex Theater, Saturday, September 19th, 2026. It's an evening that honors the past, embraces the present, and looks toward the future. Guest appearance by Ardeshir Farah of Strunz and Farah. Further information available at thealex.com/shows and kpfk.org.
There are many ways to support the programs that you love on KPFK. Becoming a member, starting a monthly gift, donating a vehicle that you don't need anymore. And now, donating a piece of land or other real estate